Good afternoon, and welcome to, believe it or not, the last in the series for the year. Well, technically, I should say, it's the last that we'll be here for in the series this year. As I mentioned in my email, we are one medrash short of completing the chapter, and that's simply unconscionable. You can't do that. So what I hope to do is sometime in the coming week to prepare the last class in the series. I will, God willing, record it, probably audio rather than video, just because if I can get away with not doing video, I will. But then I'll upload that and send you the link, so you'll be able to hear the last class on audio. You'll simply have to email me your questions and discuss the material that way. But you can't stop one medrash short of the chapter. That doesn't happen. In terms of what we're going to do next year. So I emailed Rebecca, who is the final arbiter, three different suggestions. So I'm hopeful that it will be one of the following. Either the book of Shmuel, of Samuel, the advantage there being that it has a storyline and there's depth to it as well, and it can be a very interesting subject to study for sure. A second possibility is the much dreaded book of Eov, of Job, just because maybe it is time to bite the bullet and try to actually do that book. We'll see. If we do, frankly, it's a multi-year commitment. You can't do Job in 1 year. I don't know if you can do it in two either, but whatever. And then a third possibility is the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, because they're a logical outgrowth of what we did last year when we did the book of Daniel. And we talked about the Jews who were in the Babylonian exile, so Ezra and Nehemiah would then continue from there. I apologize for not taking one of the long books of Isaiah, Jeremiah. I'm just not up to that yet. One day, perhaps.
Rabbi Strapp was in the middle of Ezra, and he's going to do Nehemiah next year.
Okay, that's fine. I did Daniel last year, and he did Daniel this year. And yeah, he and I each have our individual approaches, so you can go to one and then go to the other, and you get more than one point of view.
But the nice thing is, in the second class, you sound smart.
That's right. You can ask all the questions and say, "Wait, but in chapter 8 it's going to say," and we won't hold it against you. Yes. Well, I would have to start from Shmuel Aleph, because I don't think I can see doing Shmuel Bet without the material in Shmuel Aleph. It's so necessary. I apologize for those who would be bored for Shmuel Aleph, but I can't skip it. We'll see what Rebecca has to say, because this is co-sponsored with Mikorot, and we'll see what Mikorot says. Yes, Joyce has voted for Job. Okay, we'll see. Who knows? Whatever it's going to be, God willing, it'll be fun. That I would hope for. Believe it or not, yeah, Midrash I want to come back to at some point in some venue. I don't know when, but I had way too much fun doing Midrash to stop. You know, to stop now. So we'll have to see when it'll happen.
Do we have a vote?
Yeah, I mean, I solicited people for the last 6 weeks on topics for next year. I've been asking every single week. Oh, of these three? I'll tell you what. I've spent now almost 4 minutes on this. So let me do the Medrash first. And if there's time at the end for people to speak up on it, that would be great. Otherwise, I'll stick around for a few minutes afterwards and we can talk about it then. But I'm feeling guilty because there's so much of this Medrash to cover here. This is a long Medrash. Normally, I would have covered this Medrash in 2 weeks, not in one.
So 50 seconds. It's going back to 1:30 next year.
Oh, yes. And we're going back to 1:30 p.m. next year. Yes. The 12:30 change was not one I was particularly happy to make. It was a concession to something else, which is no longer a factor. So now we can go back to 1:30, which hopefully will be good for people's schedules. Okay. The verse that we are commenting on is found in source number 1. We've been learning about loading the boat. And Hashem had said, "Vani hineni, behold, I am going to bring this destruction." And we talked about the vav in va'ani, and I I'm going to do this. We talked about Hashem saying others had already argued for the lack of worth of humanity, and God says, now I am on board with them to the extent of bringing this Mabul. We talked about the phrase Mabul Mayim. We talked about the description of the creatures dying via the word Yigva, which was an unusual word. We talked about the brit that God makes with Noah and what that means. We talked about the entry into the boat by gender. And today we're going to have two questions regarding the following verse. Source number one. Umikol hachai, mikol basar, shnayim mikol tavil hateval hachayos itach, zachar unkeva yihyu. From all that lives, from all flesh, two from all, you shall bring to the boat to give life with you. Male and female they shall be. Our Medrash is going to be bothered by two points. One of them we already introduced at the end of last class, when the verse begins, Umikol hachai mikol basar, from all that lives, from all flesh. And the question, as we said, is, what are you talking about? If it's alive, it's flesh. If it's flesh, it's alive. What else are you talking about saving on this boat that doesn't fit one of those parameters, that doesn't fit one of those descriptions? That's our question. Now, our Medrash is going to bring an approach, but before we see the approach of our Medrash, I want to point out that others have come up with other explanations for this. We've seen that off and on this year. I haven't gone into it in great depth, but here and there I've brought examples of this where the Medrash will be bothered by something and will offer a solution, but not everybody brings the same solution that the Medrash brings. And we talked about in the very beginning of the year, way back when, the idea of Pshat and Drash and Remez, the levels of approach. Sometimes you approach with an ear for language and context. Sometimes you approach with an ear for story. There are different ways to approach a problem when you have anomalous language. So take a look at source number two for one example of this, a comment from Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, going back to the 11th century. He says, you have to look at this verse in context, in the biblical text. If you were to continue from Bereishit 6:19 into Bereishit 6:20, you would find that the next verse says, Me'ha'of l'minehu, mena'beheima l'mina, mikol remes ha'adam l'minehu, and so on. It talks about bringing the birds, it talks about bringing the animals, it talks about bringing the crawling creatures. And so as Ibn Ezra explains it, take a look at source number two, he says, V'achar sha'amar klal, mikol achai mikol basar, after it said the overall, all the living, all flesh, then it descended to specifics, and parat achar kach me'ha'of l'minei, it specified from the bird per its kind, me'ha'behema l'mina, the animal in its kind, mikol remes shu'al adama, from all the crawling creatures upon the land. So we actually did descend into specifics. So as Ibn Ezra understands it, yes, this is a problem. Saying from all the living, from all flesh is a problem, but it's answerable on a simple level in terms of the basic story. The answer is, all the living, all flesh is what we call a klal, an overall, and then you have specific examples, and we see that throughout the Torah. That's standard in biblical language. So, for example, when the Torah talks about an item that was lost, or an item given to somebody to guard, it says, any item, and then it is specific. Sure, chamor, seh, salma, an ox, a donkey, a sheep, a piece of clothing, it doesn't matter. But it gives you a klal, a general, and then it gives you a prat, a specific. So kol hachai, kol basar, is simply meant to say, all living things are coming on the boat, all flesh, and then we're going to be specific about the kinds of flesh by saying bird, beast, crawling creature. That's Ibn Ezra's approach. It's classic Ibn Ezra. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra wants to stick to the text as closely as he can, and he does not like adding in elements that are not explicit in the sentence. That's one approach to the problem. A second approach comes from the Malbim commentary from the 19th century. We go from 11th century Spain to 19th century Czechoslovakia. And look at what he says. Yadua, it is known, he says, Shemine balei achayim mechulakim, the species of living things are distinct. Im mitzad gviosehem, im mitzad nasham, sometimes species are different from each other based on their bodies. They're actually physically different. So I look at a giraffe and I say, that's not an elephant. Right? They're physically distinct, morphologically distinct, if you will. Or, im mitzad nafsham. Sometimes it's based on their character. Sometimes it's the behavior that distinguishes them. Not so much the physical structure. Now, it's hard to know what he has in mind when he says that. Is he suggesting, for example, that there are lions which are hunters and then there are lions that are vegetarians? What does he mean when he says that there are species that look alike but behave differently? Does he mean that there are owls that are nocturnal and owls that are diurnal? I don't know what he's talking about when he says that they have different behaviors. It's a question worth thinking about as we read through what he says. But he suggests that there are indeed different ways to define species. He says two species of life may be defined as being different in terms of their physical description and their structure, their limbs and so on. He says, min echad, they are one species in terms of tar gufamu binyane vareim, in terms of their body and their limbs, their structure. V'em kishnei minim nifradim mitzad halach nafsham, but they're two different species in terms of their spirit. L'mashal, for example, ze zariz v'ze atzel. One may be more energetic and one may be more lazy. And then he gives you other examples in the ellipsis. And then he says, v'tzivau Hashem, God commanded Noach, Sheyikach mikol min v'min, to take from each species. Bein osam she minim chalukim l'fi chayehem, whether species that are different in terms of their lives, meaning the way they live. Shal ze amar mikol hachai, regarding which he says, from all the living. Bein ela she minim chalukim mitzad besaram betar gufam, or those that are different in terms of their flesh and their physical description, shal ze amar mikol basar, where it says from all flesh. So Malvim is alert to the problem of our Medrash, the problem of the redundancy of take on the boat from all living, from all flesh, and he says it's not redundant. What God is telling Noah is, don't distinguish species solely based on their behavior or solely based on their physical appearance, because actually you need to divide the species on both criteria. There are species that are unique because they look different, and then there are species that are unique because they behave differently. And that's why these are both needed. It's a remarkable point of view. Coming also at a time in history when they were starting to develop systems of taxonomy, right? A post-Darwin world in which you're going to... in which you're going to look at species and define them as different, sometimes based on bone structure, sometimes based on other elements. So he's telling you that there Noah has to know how to define species on both grounds, mikol hachai and mikol basar, based on the way they live and based on the way they look. So that's another approach. Not at all what our Medrash is thinking, but Malbim suggests it. Malbim, like Ibn Ezra, is very strongly in favor of trying to answer these problems based on the text that he sees in front of him, trying to avoid introducing additional elements where he can. Not that he's going to reject Medrash either. And then there's a third approach brought in the Talmud in a legal discussion. You know that in the Torah, in Parshat Emor, towards the latter half of the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus, we are taught about offerings that are brought in the temple, in the Beis HaMikdash, and we're taught that if they have certain physical blemishes, they are disqualified from being brought. However, that section is addressed to the Jewish people, which raises a question. If a non-Jew wants to bring an offering in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, what are the rules in terms of defining a blemish? Do these rules apply? And the answer is no. A non-Jew, theoretically, can bring what we would consider a blemished offering. So does that mean anything goes? And the Talmud says no. Take a look at source number 4. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, Minayin l'machusar ever da'asur libnei Noach. I added the words in brackets. L'akriv korban. How do I know that a Noachide is not allowed to bring an animal as an offering if it's actually missing a limb? Dichsiv, Because our text says, Mikol hachai, mikol basar, from all the living, from all flesh. So what they do is read it as Amra Torah, the Torah is saying, Havei behema shechayin rashei evarim shalah. Bring a beast whose evarim are alive. The word chai there doesn't really mean alive. That's not the best translation. It means intact. It means whole. And so, you have a third way to read it. Mikol hachai, mikol basar means chai is modifying basar. Chai does not truly mean alive. Chai, in fact, means healthy, intact. And the idea is all flesh that is intact gets on the boat. Because remember, Noach is going to take from the animals that he brings on the boat and use them as a korban, as an offering to God, in a section that we're not going to get to. But that's what happens. So, yeah. Sorry? Evarim are... Evarim is not really a word that you can translate into English. I forgot that I had done this on the sheet, or I would have explained it. The word Evar does not have an analog in English. They usually translate it as a limb. But that's not an adequate translation. We are taught that there are 248 evarim in the body. However, that includes things that we call bones. It includes things that we call organs. It's not a word with an analog. In their taxonomy of the human body, there are 248 parts of the body that are called evarim. I suppose you could translate it as body part, but even that is really not adequate. So that's why I didn't translate it, but instead left it to confuse people. So we have seen now our problem, the problem of the beginning of our Midrash. The problem is this apparent redundancy in which God says to Noach to take from all that lives, from all flesh, and we have explained it in three different ways, none of which are the approach that our Midrash is going to use. Ibn Ezra says in context, it is all that lives, all flesh, which we are then going to define as bird, crawling creature, animal. It's the broad principle and then the specific application. That's Ibn Ezra. Malbim, who says that it's to teach Noach the taxonomy he should use in defining the species. Sometimes species are different because of the way they live, bless you, and sometimes they are different because of the appearance of their flesh. And then the third approach from the Talmud, that don't take the word alive, chai, to mean alive, but take it to mean intact. And the idea is all flesh that is intact goes on the boat, and from this we deduce a law. That is already a set of three explanations, and now we're going to see what our Midrash does with it. If we had more time to do this properly, I would solicit from you other explanations potentially of it, but just because we want to get through this Midrash today, since there is no next week, so I'm going to short-circuit it a little bit with apologies. But take a look at source number 5. Umikol hachai, mikol basar, shenayim. From all living things, from all flesh, two, etc. Amar Rabbi Hoshea. So Rabbi Hoshea said, Afilu ruchos nichnasim im Noach el hateva. Even spirits entered the boat with Noach. Shenamar, because it says, Mikol hachai, all living things, as distinct from all flesh. There must be something that is alive that is not flesh. Me'osan shenivru lahem nefashos velo nivru lahem gufim. Those for whom spirits were created, but bodies were not created. There is such a thing as a creature which doesn't have a body. Okay, that was easy. Let's go to the second part of the Midrash.
What is he referring to?
Yeah, so what's he... What in the
beast to... I mean, who is a spirit without a body?
Right, well, they can't be deceased people because then they don't make it on the boat. The point is survival.
But we see throughout the Gemara this idea that there are...
What are they,
ghosts
of animals?
Right.
They can't be ghosts of formerly alive people, or they don't belong on the boat. They can't be ghosts of formerly alive animals. They don't belong on the boat. These have to be alive right now and in some danger from the flood.
Well, not just that.
Spirits in danger from the flood if you're just a spirit.
Yeah, that's a really good question, no? Sharon asks, so what's the danger to them from the flood? They don't have bodies. Presumably breathing isn't an issue.
But do any animals have spirits?
Yes. Yeah, Talmudic discussion on that proliferates. There's a lot to be said about it. But even without the soul, they're alive, and they won't be after they drown. What in the world is this with this spirit? What is this? What are we talking about here? No one has yet used the magic word, right? No one has yet said the word demon. Is that what this is? Well, I wouldn't really, but it's the last class of the year anyway. You know, I had a friend who speaks a lot of scholar in residence in different synagogues, and he always says, "I can say whatever I want because next week I'm not there." And I've had scholars in residence do that to me.
And
so.
Does the demon need to be kept alive like that? I mean, isn't that inside all of us as the gates on Haran? So. What do you need an extra spirit floating around?
Oh, this is not something inside anybody. This is an independent being. This is sort of an independent contractor.
So
you know, 1099 and all
so
that.
So are they saying that in fact they exist in the world?
It's just
that's what it sounds like, you know?
It's just a exact...
Oh, come on.
Where are the Ghostbusters?
Come on. That's a wimping out.
Uh-oh.
It's just an interpretation. No, we have to deal with the text as it is in front of us. Not pretend it's not there.
I think it's all of us. If we were all at Mount Sinai, we could have all been on the boat also.
Let's see what we do with this in a real way, not in a let's pretend this doesn't exist within my Torah way. Let's see what we can do with it for real.
Or does it have to be? Let's see what we do.
This is not a topic to be afraid of. We may not like what we see, but it's not a topic to be afraid of.
No one's saying we're afraid. The question is whether we take it literally.
But how do we even know what we're taking?
Well, so let's.
Yeah, take a look at source number 6. A passage from Bereshit, from Genesis, from creation. Look closely. Vayomer Elokim, and God said, Totzei ha'aretz nefesh chaya lemina. Let the ground produce living creatures, living spirits, according to their species. Behema varemes v'chayso eretz lemina. Animal, crawling creature, and beast according to its species. Birds have already been created. We're already ahead of the creation of birds at this point. We're on day 5. Vayichein, and it was so. Vayas Elokim es chayas ha'aretz lemina. And God formed the beasts of the earth according to their species. Ve'as ha'behema lemina, and the animal according to its species. Ve'as kol remes ha'adam aleminehu, and all the crawling creatures according to their species. Vayar Elokim ki tov, and God saw that it was good. Tell me something. What changed from verse 24 to verse 25? Yeah. In 24, how many creatures were going to be created? How many types of creatures, I should say?
Four.
And what happened in sentence 25?
Three.
We lost one. Oops. They're gone. You told me that the ground should produce nefesh chaya, behema, remes, chayto, eretz, lemina, and in the end, you didn't create nefesh chaya. Now, simple answer would be to do what Ibn Ezra already did, which is to say, nefesh chaya is the general principle, and then these are specific examples, and you go home happy. That would be the simple way to do it. However, there is a midrash, which I didn't bring here just in the interest of space, because it didn't add to what we were doing, but if you want to look it up, it's Bereshit Rabbah chapter 7, midrash number 5, in which they say the first verse mentioned four things, the second verse mentioned only three, and the reason for it is because these three were created with bodies, and the fourth one was only made incomplete. Nefesh Chaya was not formed completely. It was not given a body. And it's actually suggested, believe it or not, you and I are not the only ones who run out of time on Friday to take care of everything we need to do before Shabbat. But God simply ran out of time on Friday. That actually is a much harder idea for me to understand than demons. I can deal with demons. I don't understand what it means that God ran out of time. That doesn't fit any of my understanding of how this universe is supposed to work. But leaving that on the side, as an explanation of how they ended up without a body, there are creatures that are created that do not have a physical aspect.
Is the concept of soul later on have anything to do with that?
Well, soul is there in Genesis 1.
No, well, but the concept of soul in Nefesh Chaya, any connection?
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt, that's what's being suggested here, is that the Nefesh Chaya that God wanted to create was indeed a soul that ended up being disembodied.
Maybe there are more souls than there are bodies.
That's exactly what's being suggested.
Okay.
That's exactly what's being suggested. Ah, what is their purpose? Take a look at source number 7.
Well,
I wanted to answer her question. Yeah, go ahead.
There are all sorts of problems here.
You think?
First of all, the word for spirit is different from the word that's used up above.
What do you mean?
One is nefesh, and this one is ruach.
Where do you see that? Nefesh. Wait, I want to know which one you mean. Oh, you're reading the one in source number 5? Well, Malbim wasn't talking about that altogether. Malbim was dealing with normal, you know, animals with bodies. You can see them, touch them, you know, that kind of thing. The problem is that I translate ruach as spirit, and I translate nefesh as spirit. That may be what's creating the problem. Because both are used that way.
It's translated as kind.
No, kind was on the minehu.
That's min.
That's min. Min is an entirely different thing. But you're right. I'm translating nefesh and ruach as spirits. If you want to get more specific, there's a medrash elsewhere in Bereishit Rabbah that talks about nefesh, ruach, chaya, neshama, yechida, and the different ways that they correspond to different activities of the soul. But at the end of the day, these all refer to a form of soul, and I feel comfortable lumping them together in that way. So what we're talking about is, yes, soul without a body. Then the question is, so why? What in the world are they doing here? Take a look at source number 7, a passage from the Talmud. Shisha devarim ne'emru b'shedim. 6 things are said regarding shedim. Shed is a term used to refer to that which is best translated in English as demon. Not in the sense of demon that works against God, right? Angels and demons and whatever else, but in the sense of a being that exists that is non-physical. Shlosha kemalachei asharet. In 3 ways, they are like the ministering angels. Ushlosha kibnei adam. And in 3 ways, they are like people. I skipped the ones that are like the angels in the interests of space on the page. But the 3 that are like people are ochlin v'shosin kibnei adam. They eat and drink. No word on what the menu is.
No body and no mouth.
Yeah.
And we know this for a fact.
They eat and drink like people. Parin v'ravin kibnei adam. They procreate like people. Umesim kibnei adam. And they die like people. They have a lifespan.
I'm sitting between 2 people.
Yeah, I know. You have to move, Joyce. You have to move, Joyce. They're that's the only solution for you. Sorry?
What are they here for?
Yeah, so...
What if they can't? What if they don't?
So I will respond to Jean's very good question by asking you what the message that you see in source number 7 is. What is source number 7 really trying to tell you about them? What is it really trying to say?
Maybe their souls that haven't ascended to heaven?
Maybe. Shana?
They're the missing link between angels and human beings.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Because they display human traits and they display angelic traits. Okay.
But they have those same needs, the eating, the drinking, the procreate, and they have a limited lifespan.
But what is it really trying to say here? What is the message here? I think what Shana is saying is definitely a part of this, but I see another message here. They're just like you and me. The message here is, these are not outside of the natural order. Yes, it's true, there are things about them that are strange, such as the fact that when they look in the mirror, there's nothing looking back at them. And perhaps the idea that they can...
You don't know that.
Okay, but there's no body. There's no body.
But then how are they looking?
The same way that some angel can look. There's perception without vision. Which we know anyway, that there's perception without vision.
But the idea... living beings.
Says who?
Well, I'm asking you. A living being is here for a limited amount of time with obligations and responsibilities and something to accomplish in this life, and then their allotted time is finished, and they go to dust.
So the way that the Midrash is taking it is exactly that point. Everything that God creates has a role to play in this universe. Come on, I'm gonna let them vote on whether we do Eov. I have to tell you this, but Eov's gonna take you right back to demons. In terms of this, of what we're doing now, before we get to that, the the idea that's being expressed here is that these are part of the natural order. That there is nothing that limits God from, it says, God can only create living things that have bodies. God is perfectly capable of creating things that don't have bodies. And there's no reason, that's the point of the Midrash here, that's the point of the Talmud here, reading it into the verse in source number 6. These don't need to be viewed as something outside of the natural order. God created giraffes. For what reason on earth? For us to admire them in the zoo? For them to be part of the ecosystem in Africa? I don't know. But God created giraffes, and He created spiders, and He created viruses. And by the way, He created spirits that don't have bodies. And what do? Look for yourself. They hang out eating and drinking. Yes?
You can't really suggest, first of all, Shadim and Hushaf and the Lachim don't need a physical place. They can travel anywhere. And so they don't need to be in the ark to survive.
Yeah, and that's a problem, isn't it?
It's suggesting that Noah knew the difference.
Yeah, how does Noah know when he has two of them on board?
Went out of his way to select Shadim.
Wait, there's a third one here.
It's impossible.
This is a problem. Not to mention, how many rooms do they need? If they don't have a body. These are all good questions. Yes?
Can we, with the body, sense their presence, see them? Or if we're eating, do they just come, oh, look, it must be a spirit here because some of my food is missing.
And what about those special ones? How about a witch to live?
What witches? There are no witches in this picture.
So
there are no demons in the picture either because they don't come out on film. But
do we sense their presence? Do we sense their presence?
So these are all really good questions. I mean, the Talmud is, as Rebecca mentioned before, replete with discussion about these creatures in a variety of contexts. Talking about their involvement in illness, talking about their involvement in all sorts of things. And it is very clear that there is a belief among various sages of the Talmud in the existence of what's being described here. But let me make sure, I want to reduce this to a couple of key questions, because I think that all the questions that we're asking fundamentally come down to just a couple of questions. Question number one is, if these exist, why are we not in any way, shape, or form aware of them in a scientific way? In other words, I've never seen them, we've never detected them, and they sound an awful lot like a mythological solution to problems. In other words, I can't figure out what happened to my food. I left the room and I came back and now it's not there. It must have been a demon that took it. That's what they sound a lot more like. And I'm trivializing it with that example, but you're aware that you could use the same thing to explain illnesses and so on, using that same concept. So question number one is, if these exist, why don't we see them around us, not see visually, but why don't we sense them? We've gotten very good with our detective devices and our understanding of the way the natural universe works. These don't figure in. That's one key question. A second key question is, why doesn't the biblical text speak of them explicitly anywhere and account for them? Right? Meaning, malachim appear throughout biblical text. Right? I mean, there is, within the Midrash I taught in a different Midrash series, the Midrash asks, so when do they appear in the days of creation? And there's discussion, day 2, day 5, that's its own piece. But the second question would be, if these are real, where are they in the biblical text? And we actually come back to that, because that is something that can be addressed. I think those are the two significant questions from which all the other questions, like, you know, how does bringing them on a boat make sense? Why do they need to be on a boat, and where are they going to go, and what are they going to do, and so on, and how is Noah going to deal with them? These are all, I think, sort of second-tier questions for which you first have to deal with the first-tier questions. Now, in terms of these two questions, I'm now going to add a third, which is this essential to Judaism? In other words, the same way that we have sort of Maimonidean principles of faith, or other principles of faith that are articulated by others, you know, you have to believe that the soul is immortal, you have to believe that there's reward and punishment, those type of things. Is there a, you have to believe in the existence of demons? I don't want you to answer the question. I want to answer the question.
It's not essential to this story.
I would want to add an additional question if you entertain it, and that is, if we look at the discussions, the rabbinic discussions of demons, and we look sociologically at the same time, were other cultures dealing with demons? And so, for instance, when the Talmud deals with the concoctions you throw in your, you put in your eyes so that you will see a demon, were we the only culture that came up with grinding out black cats to put them in our eyes so we could see a demon? Or were other...
Black cats.
What?
They're not black cats. Go ahead.
What was it? Was it not black cats?
There is a cat, daughter of a seventh cat. And you're talking about the beginning of Brachos, yes, but I don't think it's black.
Anyways, whatever, something. But the point is, sociologically, were Jews and were there other cultures that were doing the same things, trying to explain what was then inexplicable, different events, and so were we...
All this stuff came in the post-biblical world. All these commentaries from the post-biblical world.
Don't say for sure so quickly,
and
just wait.
They were exposed to all these
Christian
and Muslim...
So it's very important to understand, wait, we're conflating things that should not be conflated. Number one, belief in demons is pre-Christian, pre-Muslim. We can blame them for an awful lot of things, but we can't blame them for that. That's number one. Number two, we're going to find it in biblical times, but not necessarily as a Jewish belief. Hang in there. Shana.
I just want to say in response to Rebecca's question, in a way, from a historical point of view, from a critical point of view, it might be interesting to know what was happening in surrounding nations. But the fact that other nations believed in demons doesn't mean that we either did or didn't, or that we were either correct to or not correct to.
Right.
It's just another piece of fact.
Right. I taught a class last year on the topic of possession. The idea of being possessed by somebody. And it's interesting that in the early days of the church, Bishop Oregon is involved in an exorcism in which he invokes the wisdom of Solomon and Solomon's ritual for exorcising a demon. From a Dybbuk, excuse me. Now, we don't have any such tradition that King Solomon was involved with exorcising anybody. Nor do we know where he got this from. But it's worth noting that actually other cultures traced it to us. So that it's quite possible that there are, hypothetically somewhere anyway, descendants of ancient Near East cultures who look at this and say, yeah, they got it from the Jews. That the Jews actually are the ones who gave them the demonic concept. So let's, how things are, contagion is interesting.
Or the Assyrians.
And who's to say that they got it from us or we got it from them? We may not like this idea, but we can't necessarily blame it on others. So let's see. It's one thing that is clear is that our Midrash comes up with this idea to explain what is a problem in a verse. I come back to the point that I've been stressing all year long, which is in Midrash it's all about ear for language. And they're bothered by what a chai is that is not basar. What is a living thing that is not flesh? And there's an answer ready to hand. The answer is, well, we have a belief that God created things that were spirit and were not flesh. It's actually, once you accept that they exist, it's a very reasonable thing to make that leap and say, well, that's clearly what's being referred to here, understanding that we still have Rita's question to deal with and the various questions that are associated with it of why does it need to be there? Where is it going to live? What's it eating on the boat? Dot, dot, dot. But let's go a little further with this because it's worth adding some information here. Take a look, please, at source number 8. This is regarding the commandment to the Jews to bring their offerings only at the temple site, at the site of what is first the Mishkan and then the Beit HaMikdash. V'lo yizbichu od ezivcheihem la'si'irim asherheim zonim achareihem. God says to Moshe, to Moses, no longer shall the Jews slaughter for the Si'irim, which I translated as goats, after which they stray. Goats, historically, have been associated with demonology, right? The idea of the goat horns and so on. He's not talking about people who were sacrificing to goats because they believed that the goat was a god, but rather it's talking about a belief in demons that goes back to biblical times and that there is a concern that God has that Jews are going to stray into goat worship. And I'm not discussing right now the Seir Lazazel, the scapegoat of Yom Kippur, because yes, that does tie into this, but no, I can't explain it. And so what you see here in source number 8 is that in biblical times, there is a belief that there are things out there that do not inhabit bodies, and that some would even worship. Ralph.
Well, in Greek culture, a pan and the goat represents pleasure and sexual attraction.
Right, but there are, number one, that's later than this, and number two, it's not necessarily tied into this in particular. That's tied closer to the nature of a goat than to the nature of a demon. The pan myths are much more about goats than they are about demons.
That's true.
But take a look at number 9 and see what the Rambam, what Maimonides had to do with this in the 12th, 13th centuries. This is part of a discussion that he has about things that we don't believe in and the origins of idolatry. And he says, 9 is the Hebrews at the bottom of one side, the English is on the top of the other. Vehem, those people, he means idolaters, asher yazdu es gezeras hakochavim. They were the ones who established the decrees of the stars, astrology. Ve'akishuf, and magic, balachashim, incantations, v'horadas haruchniyos, bringing spirits down to earth, v'sichos hakochavim, the speech of the stars, v'ashedim, they are the demons, v'akesem, and sorcery, v'anichush, and omens, l'chol ribui minehem, and all of their various species, udrishas, hamesim, trying to communicate with the dead, v'harbe me'ele ha'inyanim, and many such things, asher shalfa ha'torah ha'amitit harva aleihem, v'charta otam, against which the Torah, the true Torah, unsheathed its sword and cut them off. V'heim sharash avodah zarah v'anafa, they are the root and branch of idolatry. That is Maimonides' position. He does not believe, it appears, from this and other comments of his, he doesn't believe that they exist. And when asked, well then, what are you going to do with the fact that they appear in the Talmud? His answer is that they are recording ideas of their time. That it's not something that that was necessarily an authentic Jewish belief, as much as this was taken as day-to-day reality. In the same way, when we talk about medicine and there are various Talmudic medications, if someone today were to ask me, what do you take for strep throat? So I may recommend a particular antibiotic that I've heard of that, oh yeah, people always say that one should take this, go see your doctor. So in their day, someone reports that they have something wrong with some part of their body. So yeah, this is what we take. And it's not that it's been analyzed and debated and discussed Talmudically. It's simply, this is what we do. And similarly, when we look at our natural world, we believe that such things exist, much as when physicists over the last 100, 150 years have suggested different explanations for how the universe works. They have proposed various ideas, some of which have been accepted, some of which have been rejected over the decades. And at various times, rabbis have sought to explain ideas within the Torah or Talmudic ideas based on those concepts from physics. Quantum theory in particular. Rabbis embraced that and loved that idea. And said, well, you can use this to explain this and that and so on. Ideas come and ideas go. And when they are held as legitimate, oh, that explains this. And if they get discarded, then you say, oh, I guess that doesn't explain this. But that's the nature of things. And that would be a Maimonidean perspective on what's going on here. Our Midrash is bothered by the idea, as it seems to be implied, that there are living things that don't have bodies. It resorts to the response of, well, there are such things because that's normal for them. And if I live in an age when that has fallen out of favor, then I come up with another explanation for what the Torah was trying to tell me. And that's another way to look at it. But I want to befuddle you for one more moment. And that is source number 10. Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner kept a set of notebooks with ideas that he didn't publish in his other works. But after he died, his notebooks were read and studied, because that's what happens to people after they pass on if they don't burn them. And in a memorial volume for him, in the introduction, the following idea was recorded. The thought of Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner, who was a great rabbi from the middle of the 20th century, his thoughts on what Shadim are, what these creatures are. If you understand this, I would love for you to explain it to me. I read it and feel like I'm on the cusp of something that's very deep and meaningful, but I don't know what it is. The adua ma'amar avos de Rabbi Nasan shekoma sheyesh ba'olam yesh ba'adam. He says in the body of Medrash called Avos de Rabbi Nasan, it's an expansion of Pirkei Avos. We find the statement that all that exists in the universe exists in man. Everything found in the universe is in the human being. Hang on. V'hu adin, I haven't even gotten to the confusing part yet. V'hu adin le'idach yisa. And the same thing is true in the opposite direction. All that exists in the human being exists in the universe at large. V'hine, ba'adam nimtza b'moach kawach hadimyon. In people, you find the power of imagination. She'b'kawach zeh, ha'adam mitzayer la'atzmo mitzius she'ena mitzuya b'chlal ha'olam. Through imagination, a person can imagine something, design for himself, a reality that doesn't actually exist. You can imagine whatever you like. Right? Elephant through the eye of a needle type thing. You can imagine whatever you want. It only exists in the mind of the person who is imagining it. Well, since there's such a possibility within a human being of imagining something that isn't real, there must also be something like that in the universe as well. Abrios halalo heim heim hanikraim shadim. And that's what these shadim, demon spirits, are. You can't until we finish reading this. Klomar, meaning, shem mitzius bilti mitzius. They are an existence which is not an existence. Vihine. When we say something is imaginary, what we mean is it doesn't exist in the world around us. When I say something is imaginary, I mean it's not here. But when you talk to somebody who is a psychologist, someone who deals in human psychology, bivadai, definitely, certainly, when he's investigating the workings of a person's brain, when he's talking to a person about what he's thinking, to that person, that is very real. What we imagine psychologically can have great weight within our lives. And here I'm not talking about the spurious imagination of, you know, imagining an elephant through an eye of a needle. But when people have psychoses, when people have emotional issues, they're very, very real to them. And even if logically they know that they're not real, logically they know that their anxiety or their fear is not substantive. But emotionally, it's very real. It's very present. So he says, that's the idea, that there can be something which is real in your imagination, even though it doesn't exist in the world. And he says, Ulahachi Shapir, you're not paranoid unless they have to get you, how did the line go? Something like that. Ulahachi Shapir Kasav Harambam to shade the main of a Mitzius Klal, which he says is why it's okay for the Rambam to say they don't exist. They don't exist. They exist in the imagination of the universe. I don't know what in the world I just said. But it sounds deep, no?
To take it to a simple, I'm a dog, a little cat comes in, and I'm terrified of cats. In reality, everyone knows, and maybe even logically, I know that there's nothing to be, that cat isn't going to hurt me, but I'm still terrified of cats. The shading don't exist, but we all, and you use the term psychosis, okay? Somebody might imagine something that doesn't mean that it exists in reality.
Okay, and maybe that's all he's saying. I don't know. I've been struggling with this for almost a year now, trying to figure out what this means. Yeah.
Every child knows that parallel worlds exist. And they've read it in their storybooks, and Alice in Wonderland, C.S. Lewis. The world is full of parallel universes that children accept without question.
Mm-hmm.
And what about Einstein? He developed this idea of something existing that nobody else had heard of before. What do you know? It's real.
Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that demons could be real after all? Is that where you're going?
In our imagination.
Boy, this whole year was worth it just to get Ralph on that.
In our imagination. That's what literature is.
I still keep thinking of it as the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa. Because the evil and good exists in all of us. And we have to maybe take it with us in order for our goodness to mean something. If you're not challenged, so being good is not a big deal. You don't know any other way. The goodness only has meaning when you overcome the other way of thinking, the other way of being. And maybe that's what it's about.
The genies aren't all bad. So how do you...
None of them are bad necessarily.
No, these aren't necessarily bad.
But a ghost or a spirit that doesn't exist is... There's also this concept of the spirit wandering who hasn't found its place and hasn't achieved the la la. He didn't.
So for the good. So you see it also challenging you for the good in your.
To me, that's what I think that it's a wandering soul, and I can't see the purpose of a soul being created without a body. It's supposed to be a temporary state of affairs when the soul has not reached its.
I hear what you're saying. I happen to think that in this case I wouldn't associate it with the Yetzer Tov, Yetzer Hara. This sounds like an independent being. And who knows? Maybe there are souls out there without bodies. Frankly, it's not the strangest thing Judaism has asked me to believe in. We spent a whole year on this flood. Yes. Yes.
Like even with Isaac, Abraham was going to kill him. The angel, she cried. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's all these.
Well, angels exist throughout Torah. That's true. The problem, really, that I would have, or maybe it's not a problem, but the distinction I would draw between what we call a malach and what is being identified here is that a malach is an agent that God uses to carry out a task. This is just like a giraffe, except that it doesn't have a body. In other words, it's just its sole purpose is to wander around doing stuff here on earth. Shana's point notwithstanding about the fact that we have put them somehow in the angel hierarchy by decorporealizing them. But nonetheless, they really are depicted, and if you look Talmudically, they're definitely depicted as just like you and me. They just, don't gain weight.
So what does that... But in terms of philosophy, is it not the Rambam? I mean, but they do say that all of those incidents in the Torah never really... I mean, there are those who they never really happened.
Only when he's dealing with communication between human and malach. That's not the same thing as saying that malachim don't operate, just that they don't communicate with people.
Okay.
Do malachim have souls?
Oh, boy. Pass.
I mean, are they not corporal beings simply sent out to do God's will? They don't have a choice, I think.
Right. So that requires really its own class. It's not a simple question to answer. That really needs a lot more discussion.
So what does God need them for? Like he has the ministering angel that's supposed to help people.
What does God need spiders for? They have some role to play in the ecosystem that he created. Yeah. They're here for something. Rita and then Ralph.
This reminds me of children. I had imaginary friends that I used to have tea parties with. You know, kids.
That's what I said.
And, you talk to them and they're your imaginary.
Right, so that's what... Right.
That's what this reminds me of.
But I feel like he's saying something greater than that when he talks about this. I feel like there's something more that Rabbi Huttner is trying to express than simply saying, so these are imaginary beings. If that was all he wanted to say, he could have said that in one sentence. I feel like there's something else that he's going for here, and I don't know what it is. Ralph, and then we really... I mean, whatever. Yeah.
You can take this one step further and suggest that all he's talking about is the transmigration of souls and
He's not. The reason I say that...
the bringing back to life souls that have departed. But the important thing is that in an absolute desperate situation, you've got to see a possibility in the future. Otherwise, you just want to give up. You won't survive.
That's what
the situation is.
But before you go to any of that, we are reading that into a biblical verse on day 5 of creation. Not only have no human beings died, they don't exist yet. It can't be a soul of somebody who lived before. It just doesn't work. That has to be something separate. Also, once they're dead, they shouldn't be vulnerable to dying again. There is that catch. I mean, we haven't answered a whole bunch of questions. We haven't answered why they're in danger from the flood. We've said that they die, but we don't know how. We haven't said, so the question of, so how does Noah know when he has two of them on the boat? There's a whole lot that is entirely incomprehensible about this. But it is a perfect example of trying to explain an anomaly in the text. That's really what we're getting at here. Trying to explain a problem in a pasuk and drawing on what we do have within tradition to do it. We had three other answers. Ibn Ezra, Malbim, and the Talmud in Avodah Zarah gave different approaches. But this is another approach to the text. I'm going to take Joyce's question and then I'm going to figure out what to do next. Yes?
Is there any suggestion that the first pasuk, from all that lives and from all the flesh, is one and the same, just repeating sort of like from the body and the soul, but it's the same, just repeating that every creature has a body and a soul?
That's interesting. I haven't heard it suggested, but it's an interesting idea. I would like it more if there was an and.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have to have the end. So Joyce is suggesting another approach in which you read it as the simply saying, from every body and soul.
Yeah.
From every body and soul, to you shall bring to the boat, and so on. It's an interesting read, that's for sure. Right, so the basar is meant to exclude the plants? Maybe. We can discuss this forever and not know, exactly all. Well, first of all, not answer the pasuk, but also not understand the demons' business. Not to mention the birds, by the way. The birds actually do get in there. I shouldn't say that. But what we've accomplished is to discuss Kol HaChai and Kol Basar. The demons part was fun, but we missed the second and third parts of this medrash. So what I'm going to do is, I had already said in the email, I mentioned in the beginning of the class today, we are, even with all of this, we're one medrash short of finishing the chapter. So I expect to put together a class on that, record the audio for it, and send you the link when I upload it, so that you'll be able to catch the rest of the chapter. Now I'm going to do it also with parts B and C for this medrash as well. Because, that's just the way it is. Which is good, actually, because I was hoping not to have to deal with Source 13, the third part of this medrash. The Peanut Butter Gallery is going to have to email me their questions. That's just the way it works. But as I said, first of all, let me just kill